Well, thank you very much for inviting me to be with you, and thank you, Jamie, for that rather exaggerated welcome, but it is a pleasure to be with you once again. And it's been quite moving so far in the service and in the previous service to be reflecting upon the awesome significance of this particular day. I was very moved by the comments of Dick Dowsett at the communion service about the member of his family, and I was reflecting that my own family had a modest contact with the horrors of war, both the First and Second World War. Both my grandfathers were involved in the war, one in the Dardanelles, one in Europe, and both of them suffered significant but not life-threatening injuries. My father wanted to be in the Merchant Navy during the Second World War because he had sailed with the Orient Line in the 1930s as an engineer, but he was assigned to work on making anti-aircraft guns, and appears on some family documents as a gunsmith. He was an engineer who became a fishmonger. But when I see these documents, it just reminds me of some of the realities. But I had a rather interesting and somewhat amusing connection with the war, all unexpectedly, and it was one of Jamie's pictures that reminded me of it. My son Douglas, who works with UNICEF and is working abroad, met Alice in London, and on the first occasion that we were invited to Alice's parents' home before they were married to meet the family, I had a rather strange and somewhat uncomfortable experience. You know that feeling that prospective father-in-laws sometimes have of not quite knowing what to say? And so I was standing in the sitting room looking at the family photographs on the mantelpiece, and just about to ask who this was when I noticed in one of them Winston Churchill. And I thought, wow, we're way in over our head here. And so a gentle inquiry later as to how Winston Churchill came to be in a photograph with several other naval personnel on the mantelpiece turned out that my daughter-in-law's grandfather was a vice admiral. Admiral, I'm sure he was admirable, but a vice admiral who had been responsible for locating those harbours that you saw in that slide, those Mulberry harbours. He had control of that and was directing it on the days of the landings. And so immediately after the landings, or not long after the landings, Churchill visited. Churchill actually wanted to go over on D-Day, but they managed to persuade him not to. And so they had met for lunch afterwards, and this photograph was taken of the Admiral grandfather and Winston Churchill. So that did get the conversation started eventually. My son referred to this at his wedding, talking about Alice's grandfather and saying that he had a grandfather too who was a man of the sea, but he was a fisherman from Fraserburgh and not quite in the same league. However, it is a solemn business to reflect on war. And I'd like to take a moment, if I may, just to read briefly from two further passages. I want you to keep thinking about the passage that we read together from Isaiah chapter 2, but I'll read just a few verses of two other passages. You don't need to turn to them unless you want to, but this is from Matthew chapter 24. As Jesus was standing on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. "Tell us," they said, "when this will happen, the destruction of the temple, and what will be the signs of your coming and the end of the age?" And Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Christ, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come." And verse 14 says, "And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." And the second short reading is from the last book of the Bible, from the book of Revelation chapter 21, verse 1. "I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. May these encouraging passages be a comfort and a challenge to us this morning as we think of weighty and solemn matters. I quite like the Andrew Marr show. I can never really listen to it because it's on at church time, but I just caught the beginning of it this morning. I normally record it and watch it on Monday. And Andrew Marr, in his own inimitable way, began by asking the question, what is the point of remembrance? What is the point of remembrance after 100 years? And then he went on to say something I thought was pretty profound. He said, well, remembrance gives us perspective. When we look back at the horrors and the miseries and the tragedies of war, when we think of the disastrous decisions that were made in the pursuit of war, and when we reflect on some of the wiser decisions that enabled war to be brought to an end, it gives us perspective. The perspective he commended to us was, we are a free people. We are a people unlike many in the world who are free to make our own decisions through a democratically elected parliament. We sometimes forget, he insisted, of what it is we have. Out of all the misery and tumult of war, we are a free people. In fact, he said, we are a lucky lot. And it registered with me that it is easy to be dismissive and critical of all that happened in the past, but in a very real way, we are the inheritors of blessings that many people in the world would aspire to. So there is a point in remembrance. There is a point in gaining some sort of perspective. And it is an awesome moment to stand on the Sunday that marks 100 years since the armistice which ended World War I. The scale of that war was frightening. 700,000 British soldiers lost their lives. 250,000 additionally from the Commonwealth and Empire also lost their lives. Approximately 75,000 soldiers, their bodies were never found. And Charles Moore, writing in the Telegraph yesterday, said that when we think about war, we should think and we should remember that it is about the common soldier. I wonder if any of you caught Martin Bashir's piece on the news last week. Martin Bashir is an active Christian. In fact, Martin Bashir had contact with a good friend of mine, the late Max Donald, when he was a youth pastor in London, and Martin Bashir was in his Bible class. And Martin Bashir, of course, you know, became very famous as the journalist who conducted the interviews with Princess Diana, went to America for a time, said something out of turn, apparently, on a news channel, probably something of a Christian flavor, and had to stand down, but has returned, thankfully, as the religious correspondent of the BBC. And he was talking about the story of stories of soldiers and the war. And there was one particular story as he interviewed the grandson of a soldier. This soldier on the Western Front had been hit by a bullet. But the bullet had struck a New Testament that was in his breast pocket. And the thrust of Bashir's interview was, do we make too little of the fact that these soldiers carried the Bible with them into battle, and many of them took comfort, direct comfort, from the sayings of Holy Scripture? And this particular soldier, his life was saved by a bullet that lodged itself in the New Testament that he was carrying in his breast pocket. When he recovered sufficiently to take the book out of his pocket and open it, this seems incredible. The point of the bullet had stopped at Isaiah chapter 49, verse 7. And you really need to read it in the King James Version, that book of books, to get the point of it. The bullet had actually stopped at a verse, Isaiah 49, verse 7, which says, thus saith the Lord, I will preserve thee. Now, I know we smile at people who use the Bible as if it was a kind of almanac, but I think if you were that soldier in that situation, finding that verse, I think you would be forgiven for thinking that God spoke to you. And it was an interesting piece about the importance of the Bible. But, of course, there was another side to the First World War, a side which was much darker and much more serious. The cultural impact of the First World War was that it destroyed the faith of many people. I found a book recently called The Great War and the Death of God, written by Charles O'Connor III. And this is what he says in a section entitled World War I and the Ascent of Materialism. He says, "The war's effect on Western culture and its intellectual elites was profound." In his comprehensive study of the subject, American historian Roland Stromberg concluded, "The Western world would never quite recover from the shock. The mind's distrust of itself, of thought and expression and reason, was a permanent legacy, a legacy of skepticism and nihilism and cynicism found in all intellectual circles, one is tempted to say, ever since. Those intellectuals, artists, and writers who endured and survived the war retreated from their pre-war cultural heritage and worldview. They distrusted human reason, abandoned metaphysical inquiry, and began to doubt the transcendent. Instead of re-engaging the eternal questions about the nature of reality and restoring meaning and purpose to the fractured post-war world, Western culture defaulted. A modern scientific worldview, scientific materialism, filled the cultural vacuum and came to dominate the shattered post-war landscape." And it is salutary to think, and perhaps not surprising, of the devastating effect that the war, the World War I, had on the culture and thinking of the West. But there was, of course, a much more immediate damaging effect, because the First World War was hardly the end of war, and as we've been reminded that 20 years later, the world was at war again in an even more vicious and extensive way. Certainly, fewer British servicemen died in the Second World War, though the number is around 400,000. But the Second World War became the civilians' war, and more than 50 million people, 50 million people, that's almost the population of these British Isles, mostly civilians, died in the wars, the war that was conducted between 1939 and 1945. It is humbling and hideous to think of all that happened. I was born on the 12th of April, 1945. 3 weeks before the end of the Second World War. I was actually born on the same day that President Roosevelt died. Not that the two events were directly connected, but it is something that I reflect on. The 12th of April is also the day that the American Civil War began back in the 19th century, but I don't see the connection. But I do think of the uncanny conjunction of dates. My father was born in 1914, the year when the First World War began, and I was born on the 12th of April, 1945. And the life of my father spanned the most tumultuous years in human history, and I try not to forget about it. And I'm thankful to God that my experience has been that I was born in a golden age. I doubt there has been another age of human history that has been as peaceful and as prosperous, generally, for the people of this country. It's hard to think there has been an age like this. I sometimes fear we're becoming a nation of whiners. Everything seems to be a whine about what's not being done about this or that. We live in a golden age. I concede that the age coming after this one might not be as good, and I try to remain thankful. But I remember that the age that I have grown up in and lived in is also a very dangerous age. I started university in 1962, studying the sciences, and I remember being in a physics class in October 1962, one Friday afternoon, when the lecturer giving us an assignment said, "I would like you to have that finished by Monday morning," and added, and he wasn't joking, "if we are not all vaporized by then." I've never forgotten that moment. I remember the journey home on the bus, thinking, is this the weekend that the world is going to end? It was, of course, the week of the Cuban crisis. And I discovered recently that that weekend, the 27th of October, which was a Saturday, the 27th of October, 1962, is recognized as being the most dangerous day in human history. On that day, an American U-2 plane overflying Cuba was shot down and the pilot was killed. The American military put immense pressure upon President Kennedy to retaliate. But Kennedy wisely refrained, and the day passed without incident, although on that day, both the United States and the Soviet Union conducted atmospheric nuclear tests, and alarmingly, the US test on that day was codenamed Calamity. But the calamity was averted, and the most dangerous day in human history passed. And we are still here to talk about it. We should not take our peace and our prosperity for granted. We have no guarantee that this will last. We have no guarantee what the remainder of our lives will be like. But I do think a sense of thankfulness is appropriate, and a sense of determination to make the best of what we have, and as Christians to do all that we can for the furthering of the kingdom of Christ, the Prince of Peace in our world. It's very hard for Christians to think about war because everything about war is contrary to what the gospel of Christ is about. War, we have to recognize, is grim evidence of the fallenness of human beings, that we live in a fallen world. We live in a world that has become disconnected from the purposes that God intended for it. And although there are great mysteries around why God allows it, we can only deal with the realities as we see them. And war is a reminder to us of the nature of sin and fallenness in which we are all caught one way or another. If there is anything in the world that should remind us that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, then war is that reminder. But secondly, war presents a particular challenge for Christians. And it's a challenge that arises between trying to sort out the difference between our commitment and recognition of the state as an institution of God. In Romans chapter 13, Paul talks about the state. That was the Roman power, the Roman authority, and urges Christians to respect the authorities and to be subject to them, adding this remarkable phrase that they do not bear the sword in vain. And clearly, the right of states to maintain order within their own boundaries on some occasions leads to states taking action to preserve their integrity, and on occasions to try and right wrongs in states beyond their own. It's a difficult area to be in. But for Christians, we do need to recognize that the state faces particular challenges, and therefore war becomes part of the outworking of that. I read an interesting book, and picked up an interesting book over the last few weeks, written by Paddy Ashton. Paddy Ashton, I confess I didn't know he was an author, but he has written a book called Nine. That's not N-I-N-E, that's N-E-I-N. And it's a book about the resistance to Hitler during the Second World War. If you're interested in that sort of thing, I commend it to you. I haven't finished it yet, but I had no idea of the extent to which the German generals wanted to remove Hitler before the war became as serious as it did. And his argument is that part of the problem was that the Allies, and Britain and France in particular, at critical moments in the run-up to the Second World War, with the Rhineland and Austria and Czechoslovakia, when they were asked by German agents, would they make a declaration that if Hitler moved, they would move against him, thus giving them the reason to stage a coup and to stop the war before it began, The disappointing thing was that the mindset of the appeasers was that they were unwilling to give such undertakings. And so, as we know, the war that might have been stopped rolled on to its ghastly conclusion, and the triumphant Germany of 1939 disappeared in a firestorm in 1945. But it's easy to write counterfactual history, what might have been, what might not have been. Why doesn't somebody stop this, is what people would say. Well, the Americans tried it in Vietnam. Tony Blair and George Bush tried it in Iraq. And sometimes intervening with lesser wars to stop greater wars themselves turn out to be a quagmire and produce the opposite of what is intended. There are, in this area, no easy solutions. I guess the United Nations represents the best effort of the states of the world to do something about avoiding war. And yet even the United Nations, with the best of intentions, remains flawed in some critical areas and unable to act at decisive moments because of the divisions among the nations and in the Security Council. Yes, I think we should encourage people to work for peace and to do all they can to avoid war, but the reality is, in a fallen and sinful world, we are not always going to stop the designs of the ambitious, of the dictatorial, of the greedy, of the covetousness, of the afraid. And so, for Christians, I think we have to accept that war is one of the realities of the world. It is interesting that the tradition I come from, and the tradition from which I guess this church also comes from, is a tradition in which there has been very strong conscientious objection as individuals to participating in war. Indeed, I believe there is a passage in Hansard that dates back to before the First World War, when talking about introducing conscription, one member of Parliament ventured that the Plymouth Brethren and the Quakers will not be expected to participate in this. And I do have the utmost respect for those young men, some of whom I knew in my time, but in both the First and Second World War stood their ground and were conscientious objectors to taking up arms. It was a very difficult and very principled position. I just hope that we will continue to live in a country where conscientious objection is respected. It's beginning to feel now as if Christian conscientious objections to a variety of state policies are going to be overruled. But many Christians likewise saw that the state was caught in something that it had to act in, and therefore joined the military services and distinguished themselves in serving their country as they saw it. But what can we do? We're so small, we're so limited. What can we possibly do? And so may I suggest to you that as Christians, At a level of our communities and of our own individual lives, we live as men and women who believe in peace, that we promote peace, that we do what we can to build peace in our homes, in our communities, in our churches, and to show that we are emissaries of peace. Romans 14, verse 19 says, "Make every effort to do what leads to peace." And it's a bit rich sometimes to be listening to advocates of peace in the world who seem to have the greatest difficulty being at peace with their neighbours or their colleagues of a different political persuasion. I had an interesting conversation with a Free Church minister on Friday night in Campbelltown, talking about the role of the church. He said, "You know, I've come to see that churches should be seditious societies. We should work against the mood of the world. We should practice sedition, the sedition of the peace of Christ, and spread a different outlook on life, a different view of life, a view of life that is positive, peaceful, and enriching under the sovereignty of God our Father and Jesus Christ our Lord." A seditious society. He said, "I had a friend who wondered about coming to my church and said, 'Will I be comfortable if I come to your church?' And he said, 'No, not at all. You won't be in the slightest comfortable, because if I'm true to the gospel and if I preach the message of Christ, you'll be most uncomfortable, because it will be countercultural and the exact opposite of the principles that many people would take to be obviously true and correct.'" So I'm going to draw this to a close by asking you to sense in the passages that we read together that there are three things that are remarkable about war and about peace. The first is what Isaiah sensed. In this remarkable passage that is an historic passage in the scriptures, there's a version of it also in the prophet Micah, we have Joshua's sense, Isaiah's sense that there is a day coming for Judah and for the world when people will bow their swords, beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Isaiah lived at a time when Judah, a relatively small nation, not unlike our own, though our population is larger, no doubt, but one of the outcomes of the Second World War was that Britain won the war and lost its empire. So we became a relatively small nation, though a powerful and significant one to the present day. But Judah was caught between the great powers, a time of political upheaval. Egypt on the decline, Assyria on the rise, Babylon in the background. And the inevitability of conflict and war weighed heavily in Isaiah's mind. And then the passage also indicates that in Israel itself, in Judah itself, the verses we didn't read following the ones we did, there was a loss of faith in God. There was a loss of conviction about the light of Jehovah. And Isaiah is appealing to his nation to return to the Lord and to the faith and to be consistent to what had been revealed to them and to their fathers. And only in this way would there be a degree of protection from the brutal powers around them. But they didn't rise to it. And in time, Judah, like Israel, was taken into captivity. But overarching this, Isaiah has a sense of what there is to be in the future, in what he calls the last days. And in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. This is a profound passage because although it does not spell it out in detail when and how this will happen, Isaiah, like the prophets, have an undying conviction that this beautiful world that God has created, which is so distorted by sin and selfishness and war and misery, will yet find itself to be as God intended it to be. And there will be a time when they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and when nation will take up sword, not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. And that hope shines brightly from this passage and in the prophecies of the Old Testament. And what Isaiah sensed brings us to what Jesus said. Because Jesus said that we will hear of wars and rumors of wars, and nation will rise against nation, and kingdom will rise against kingdom, and you will be persecuted for your faith. But this is not the end, he says, because the gospel will be preached. This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come. Now, those of us who were brought up to be close students of prophecy, as we called it in the old days, were frequently frustrated by the lack of clarity as to when and how this would happen. So we built in our own ideas just to make it all a lot more comfortable. And so predictions of when it was going to happen and so on have discredited some of the great truths of the Bible. But Jesus was clear. War and famine and turmoil would be a consistent experience of human beings and of the world until the end came. And he said the end won't be coming until this gospel of the kingdom is preached in all the world. I was very moved by what Dick Dowsett said at our communion service this morning about committing ourselves to the message of Christ and his kingdom and the gospel. This is what we are called to do. We are called to bear witness to Christ in our lives, in our homes, in our families, where we are employed, to carry with us the light of Christ in how we live. And as we get opportunity, if we are able to speak, although you've got to watch you don't get disciplined at work nowadays, if you speak about faith, you can speak about most things, but faith is a dangerous area. But if we live as Christians, if we live in a way that shows we value excellence, that we respect relationships, that we do our work to the best of our ability, It won't be long till colleagues ask what motivates us, and we'll have the opportunity to talk about our faith. That's our calling, the gospel of peace, the gospel of Christ, and the gospel of his death and his resurrection. And Jesus speaks in this passage about then the end will come. I suppose you would have to say that the preaching of the gospel in the whole world as a testimony to the nations, you might argue that that has been largely done, although somebody will be quick to advise me of how many tribes and nations yet do not know the gospel. I was intrigued to notice recently that if, for example, the growth of the church in China continues at its present rate, there will be more Christians in China by the year 2050 than there will be people in the United States. I invite you to think about that. We live in Europe, the only continent in which the church is not growing, and we have a view of how difficult it all is and how hard it all is until you think about what is happening in other countries of the world. More Christians in China by 2050, someone predicts, than people in the United States. The gospel is being carried still to the nations in the most remarkable ways, and then the end will come. And if Isaiah sensed it, and Jesus said it, then in our last passage, we see what John saw. Isaiah sensed it, Jesus said it, and John saw it. And in a vision, he sees what it will be like at the end of the world. A new heavens and a new earth and the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And a loud voice saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them, and there will be no more death, and no more mourning, and no more crying, and no more pain, for the old order of things has passed away. There is in this world of ours a real beauty, a real intricacy. The world is beautifully designed, beautifully constructed. Human beings are the most complex living organisms that you can imagine. The stamp of God's hand is over all of it. And yet today we mourn the fact that we have defaced it and devalued it. But God's creation is not going to be rubbished and forgotten. There will be a day when it will be seen in all its beauty and in all its fullness. And there'll be no more tears and no more death and no more wars and no more crying and no more pain. And the world, the heavens and the earth, will be as God intended them to be. It's a wonderful thing for Christians to have a sense of that, and to have a sense that through Christ we can find a place in the world to come. In early August 1945, when Truman and his advisors were contemplating the end of the war in Japan and contemplating an invasion of these islands which might have cost a million men's lives, they decided to use the atomic bomb. And when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, an excited advisor came back to Truman and said to Truman, Mr. President, the results are beyond anything that you could imagine. And Truman said, in words that he probably lived to regret, but would understandably have given vent to his feeling of pressure at the time, he said, this is the greatest thing in history. What he meant was that to have a weapon that would make war unthinkable in the future is the greatest thing in history. I hope we never live to sense the inadequacy of that assessment. But it's an interesting question. What is the greatest thing in history? Is there anything in history that stands out beyond anything else? And as Christians, we would have to answer, yes, there is. The greatest thing in history is the death of Christ and his resurrection. And it is in that and through that we find peace, and in that we have a hope for the future. Brothers and sisters, on a day of sadness and on a day of chastening, let's think, What is the greatest thing in history? And the greatest thing in history is that Christ rose from the dead, lives in heaven, and will one day return. And when he returns, there will be no more war, ever. Thank you for listening so well, and may God bless his word to us. For his name's sake, amen.